Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast, originally recorded in 2000, features Ronald W. Jones, Xerox Professor Emeritus of Economics at the University of Rochester, and James Gwortney, Director of the Stavros Center for the Advancement of Free Enterprise and Economic Education. We hope you enjoy today's podcast, and don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Jim, I understand that your latest revision of the Economic Freedom Index is about ready to hit the market. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And you chose Hong Kong as the location where it's going to come out first?
The reason why it's coming out first in Hong Kong is Hong Kong, along with Singapore, are the two highest rated countries in the in the world. Yeah. And so it's being released in Hong Kong. Actually, it's being released by around the world at approximately the same time. The index now is published by a network of 53 institutes worldwide.
That's amazing. Now, thinking of Hong Kong for the moment, is it the case that the return or the transfer of Hong Kong to Chinese rule would alter the index very much, its ranking very much?
Well, it did exert a very moderate impact on it in terms of reduction in the rule of law and property rights variable, and that's one area where they went down a bit. As you're well aware of, at this point, the strategy is to one country, two economies, but so there is still, basically, there's not been a substantial change in rule of law, things of that sort, but there's some unease about the possibility of that happening in the future, and of course, that's a very important factor.
Well, I was in Hong Kong a few months ago, and it didn't seem much different to me except for some new buildings. And I asked them locally, I said, where is the military presence? And they said, well, two things help us. One is they keep them locked up in barracks. And two, even if they didn't, they'd have no money to spend.
They'd need some money in Hong Kong. But it's a very vibrant place, isn't it?
Now, how about Singapore? I haven't been to Singapore, but my own view of it is that there's a lot of private business that goes on there very successfully, and you're not allowed to chew bubble gum.
That's a pretty good
idea.
So
how are these mixed together in your index?
Well, whether or not you're free to chew bubble gum does not enter as a component in our index. But the freedom of international trade, and Singapore has one of the largest and most vibrant trade sectors as a share of their economy, is a component of our index, a very important one. Things like the barriers to entering into business and the size of the entrepreneurial or market or private sector relative to government sector also enter into the index. And Singapore, in terms of its regulation of business activity, it's relatively easy to start a business in Singapore.
Yes. Well, that's a very important thing. But going now to a somewhat different country, one that most people would think of as being very democratic, a very pleasant place in which to live, etc. Sweden. Are they number three?
No, not quite. Right off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you exactly where Sweden is. But Sweden, let me just give a little background and response. Important elements here of that enter into our index is the freedom of international trade, which I've talked about, in countries where you have lower tariffs, fewer barriers to trade, larger trade sectors, absence of exchange rate controls. These will result in the country having a higher rating. Another important area is size of government and scope of government. And as the government is large relative in terms of its expenditure level, in terms of transfer payments as a share of the economy, that will reduce its rating because it will be an increase in essentially the amount of goods and services that are allocated through the political process rather than the market process. So economic freedom is about personal choice, market allocation, protection of property rights. So countries with very large governments and large transfer sectors, this works against them. Now, another important component is monetary stability. And that is somewhat also related to the property rights issue because inflation is essentially erosion or taking of property. The currency issuing entity, in this case the government, if it dilutes the value of that, the median of exchange, money, that it is in fact taking property. So countries that have lower, more stable, that have a more stable price level, lower rates of inflation also get higher rating. Now, if you look at Sweden in that regard, Sweden's big government, big transfer sector, that works against us. But on the other hand, it's a relatively open economy, trade barriers are relatively low, and that it has followed policies in recent years that are quite consistent with price stability. So in those latter two areas, free trade, price stability, that Sweden ranks quite high. So it becomes more of a middle-ranked country. I think it's probably about 50 out of 123 in our index.
Above North Korea?
Definitely above North Korea.
Right. Now, I recall some years ago when you and I were both attending some of these conferences on economic freedom that Alan Stockman and I had to, were cooperating to do a paper on the concept of economic freedom. And one of the things that struck us was our feeling of disagreement with George Stigler's view of economic freedom, which very closely related economic freedom with wealth. And given that transfers have become a much more important part of the activity of governments, one might argue that you can transfer the income from one group to another and maintain, by and large, the wealth levels. Have you maintained the freedom levels? We argued no, that you have not. And I just wonder whether you had any ideas on now or how your index captures this notion that wealth and prosperity are not the only measure of economic freedom.
Well, as you're well aware, Ron, it's a dangerous thing to disagree with George Stigler. But in this case, with regard to not only our participation in this index, but the general consensus of the other people who were participating in developing the methodology, was we liked Jones and Stockman a whole lot more than Stigler with regard to the issue of economic freedom. It does seem to me that if, in fact, the government taxes funds away from an individual, in order to transfer them to another party, that they have violated their economic freedom.
Right.
And that, therefore, in our index, the methodology that came out of really a series of seminars that you referred to that covered, what, 1986 to 1983 or 1986 to 1993 or so, it was very strongly believed that the as you have an increase in the takings through the tax and transfer process, that that restricts freedom, and that is a component of our index, and it does in countries that have larger tax transfer sectors are in fact given lower ratings.
That's right, and I think that one of the principles that underlies the viewpoint that we're talking about is that economic freedom is not something that's sort of given to you, it's something that can be taken away.
Mm-hmm.
And what we wanted to concentrate on is the role of the state in particular in abrogating and in denying and limiting the scope of economic freedom so that you can't sort of take it from one person and give it to another.
Right.
You can take it from one person. What you're giving them is merely a transfer or wealth. Now, I think that leads into what I find a very fascinating question that has to do with the role of the state. Now, in some activities, the state has seemed to have given up its role, managing coal mines, necessarily running airlines and so forth, mm-hmm. the productive areas, owning steel mills, especially true in some of the former communist countries. However, this does not necessarily mean the government has gone down in scope. In my view, what they've done is discovered their core competence, which is regulation, monitoring, and controlling the private sector of the economy. And in that sense of the word, they're coming closer to limiting the economic freedom in the private sector.
Well, I think that area plus the transfer area that we were talking about previously is where you have observed growth of government. Actually, government consumption as a share of output in the United States is lower than it was in the 1960s. That surprises a lot of people. What we call government consumption, that is to say government actually providing goods and services to people, operating electrical plants and things of that sort. Or the military defense, of course, would also be in that category, most of it. But government's actually smaller there, but it has grown in this transfer sector. There is some evidence of at least slower growth and perhaps even a small contraction back away from the government's role in the transfer sector. If you look at the overall size of government, it's not much, and I'm speaking not here, not just in the United States, but worldwide, it's not very much larger today than it was in 1980. It's about the same. Whereas if you look between 1960 and 1980, there would have been a lot of growth of total government expenditures.
But that's a more direct measure, I think, of the direct spending mm-hmm. of government, either on goods and services or even in transfer. But there are other ways in which the government can accomplish, let's say, transfer activities. It can require, let's say, improvements in the workplace. It can support minimum wage legislation. There are other ways in which it can bring about a transfer of income from one group to another group mm-hmm. and say, my hands are clean.
That's right. And they're very difficult to, you know, any one of these generally doesn't exert an earth-shaking impact on the economy. But when you add them all together, lots of yes. these kinds of regulations, that's when they start to put the economy in a straitjacket. And I think there is certainly reason for concern here. And this is these things are harder to measure in our index. Now, we do have variables for things like interest rate controls. I mentioned exchange rate controls. We have measures of things like that pick up the impact of difficulties involved in entering into business. But the precision of some of those measurements might be a little less than in some of the other areas. And clearly that's not an exhaustive list of right. all the kinds of regulations.
Now, would you say that in some sense there's been a kind of trend in the U.S. and in Western Europe? At least in those areas, mm-hmm. for increased loss of private, of economic freedom?
No, I think overall, in what our index indicates, because our methodology allows us to reconstruct an index of
right.
economic freedom all the way back to 1970, and our index would suggest that there was a deterioration of economic freedom in the 70s. But that since 1980, that actually there has been a movement worldwide in the direction of a slightly more economic freedom.
Now, to the extent that that's so, how much weight in that is given to lowered inflation rates
mm-hmm.
and more open trade?
That would get about 20 to 25% of the weight in the overall index. And those are two areas, two of the big areas where there has been significant change. That in the trade area, you've had lower tariffs. You've also had reductions in exchange rate controls, which results in lower black market exchange rates, and pretty significant increases in sizes of magnitude of trade. In the monetary stability areas, I'm sure you're well aware of, and particularly if you excluded former socialist countries
right.
from the data of the 90s, that there's been a very decided move toward greater monetary stability in the 90s, say, compared to the 70s. So that's been two very important factors.
Yes. How about, though, the degree of regulation?
Well, some kinds of regulation have been decreasing or moving in the direction where you would expand freedom. For example, one example of that would be the regulation of the ability of individuals to hold foreign currency bank accounts. And this can be important in terms of giving you access to sound money, even if your domestic currency is not one that which has maintained its value over time. In this area, about 25% of the countries in our index had freedom to have alternative, hold bank accounts in foreign currencies in 1980. That figure is now up to about 50%.
Right.
So that would be an area where we've had some deregulation that has exerted a, I think, a positive impact not only on economic freedom, but also on economic growth.
So this is a reflection of greater globalization, as we.
It certainly
like
makes
to use
globalization, yeah. You know, makes it easier for the economy to be globalized.
Right. Now, I think it's possible to argue, and I'm not sure you would agree or not, that with this and other aspects of greater globalization, the more ease of communication, mm-hmm. of making payments, easing up on those restrictions, a greater ability to engage in foreign investment and so forth, that this creates a challenge for governments or public sectors, that if their charge, if their primary aim in many ways is to control elements in the economy, to tax them, to regulate them and so forth, what the ease of communication and transportation, those lowered costs, makes possible is that elements of the private sector can flee the jurisdiction.
It really says that our markets are becoming more competitive, and location is a market too, doesn't it?
That's right. But I think, you know, if you ask yourself, well, what happens when your subjects find it easier to escape the umbrella mm-hmm. of your control? I think one possibility is that the public sector, to the governments, are now more willing to engage in deals with other governments. And that if you look at the European Union, if you look at NAFTA and so forth, that one element that may have been driving this is a desire on the part of governments to be able better to control economic activity, to get more information for taxation, to engage in cooperation on crime, other areas like this. Governments, I think, hate competition. Mm-hmm. They're not used to it.
All of us, none of us
we
like
all
competition.
Of us hate competition. A lot of us have to get used to it. Governments, I think, don't like it. And I think there's a trade-off, if you like, between kind of sovereignty on of governments and the desire to control. They're willing to give up some sovereignty in order to make deals with their kith and kin, namely other public sectors. Now, this scenario I call the Civil War scenario, and it's only one of many that's possible. Obviously, a lot of private interests want to be in cahoots with their own government, support their government. Mm-hmm. A lot of political economy discussion is centered on that now. But I think that the changes of globalization also suggest this horizontal shift, that you're going to have private sectors trying to make use of other countries to shift the locale of their activity abroad, mm-hmm. in defense, if you like, of their property rights.
Yeah, exactly.
And that public sectors are more concerned.
That there may be some tendency on the part of, and maybe considerable tendency on the part of the public yeah. sector to try to respond to head this off.
Right.
But I think in the short term that it's actually created an opportunity for countries that have developed.
It may have opened Pandora's box wider than they had
anticipated. But it's created an opportunity for some less developed countries to achieve almost amazing economic
yes.
growth rates.
Right.
One of the things that we did as a kind of a spinoff of this report is we looked at the relationship between the countries that ranked in our top 40. They were in the top 40 type of countries.
Right.
And at the same time, they improved in the ranking by at least 20 ranks. In other words, wow. if they were previously like 50, they jumped to at least 30. So we looked at that set of countries, and there was 10 countries that were in that category. Among the countries in that category were New Zealand was one,
yes.
which is now the third ranked country in the world,
right.
Whereas in the 1980 they were like 33rd or something of that sort. Peru is another country in that category. Ireland is kind of a well kept secret. There's been a great deal of liberalization in Ireland
and growth
in Ireland, and El Salvador is another country. Very substantial change in economic liberalization, their trade policies, their monetary policies, and reductions in size of government as a share of the economy. Argentina is another case. But in any case, these 10 countries that had this, either jumped, they were in the top 40 and they jumped 20 rankings. Their growth of real GDP in the 1990s thus far, the first 8 years of the 1990s, was 4.4%.
That's amazing.
Now, that's really, when you consider that the world growth rate is about, during that period of time, was about 2%, it was roughly twice that.
Right.
And so this does open up an opportunity for a country that is willing to liberalize and give its citizens more economic freedom to achieve rather phenomenal rates of economic growth. You know, Ireland, now the per capita income, purchasing power parity method comparison, the per capita income in Ireland now is almost identical. In fact, some estimates place it a little bit higher than the UK.
Than the UK, right.
Isn't that amazing?
But speaking of Ireland, they're also, they're members of the European Union, but they're under criticism because of their tax rates.
They're low. Too low, their tax rates.
They're too low. And the Germans, for example, are exclaiming that there should be harmonization. And it makes you wonder whether harmonization is another word for collusion.
Right? Well, I don't wonder much about it. I'm sure that it is.
Yes.
And I think that it's going to be vitally important for the countries like Ireland in the EU. I believe the common currency in Europe can reduce trade barriers and can be a very positive thing for Europe. But if, as a result of that common currency, rather than the countries which now have very restrictive labor markets and very high taxes, yes, that rather than them bringing their taxes in line and competing, that they attempt to use the EU to impose their high tax welfare state policies on countries that have moved less in that direction, that then it's going to be it's going to have a negative impact.
And I think that raises an important question for countries that want to claim they want to join the EU, Poland, Hungary, etc. What are they getting into? The farmers would love it if they could, because of the
if they could
high
get those subsidies.
If they could get those subsidies, etc. But there are alternatives in terms of the world trading system that countries or regions like Hong Kong, Singapore, etc. have illustrated. That wheeling dealing in the world market is not a bad way of getting ahead in this world.
Exactly.
So it's an interesting that's an interesting question.
Well, I think the World Trade Organization and, frankly, our policy toward the World Trade Organization is an interesting illustration of what you're talking about, of whether or not deregulation is going to win out or whether the entity is that was established to lead to more liberalization. And after all, the World Trade Organization, an outgrowth of GATT, which for many years was essentially a deregulatory agency designed to reduce tariff barriers, reduce non-tariff barriers. That's its roots, if you like. And now the developed countries, and frankly, headed by the United States, are attempting to turn the World Trade Organization into a regulatory agency, where it would impose various types of labor standard type of regulation,
environmental,
and types of environmental regulations on other countries in the world. Now, this is an effort to make the World Trade Organization into something that it was never intended to be. And if we go down this route, it will result in less trade and less economic progress as a result of trade than what otherwise would be the case.
That's right. And another aspect of this is that before the WTO, when for 40 some odd years we had GATT as the agency through which we got 8 rounds of tariff reductions, the GATT was almost unique amongst world organizations, as it were, in having a very small body of employees. And once it became the World Trade Organization,
institutionalized,
they took over the whole building there in Geneva, they've become much larger, and you get this other alteration in its purpose. So I think they tend to go together, this sort of size and the shift towards regulation instead of deregulation?
Well, Ron, as a graduate student, and I don't know whether I've shared this with you before or not, but I read a good bit of your work, in fact, particularly one of your papers, I think it was in the JPE, that we spent almost a whole term going over it on international trade.
It takes that long to
understand. Yeah. For some of us. But in any case, your contributions in the trade area I've always admired, and I'd be interested in your sharing your views about how do you think this is going to shake out with regard to, I think you would agree that we've had a period of, let's say, a couple of decades now of movements toward trade liberalization. But yes, there are some clouds on the horizon, aren't there?
Yes, and I think that to follow up on what I call the Civil War scenario, I think that there will be an increase in sort of economic freedom, but at the expense of government control. I think the nation state is, in a sense, withering away because the playground for the private agents is now much more worldly, and there's less room for interference at the national level. Now, as I say, one way in which I think governments are responding to this is trying to harmonize their activities to take away that element of choice, that menu of possibilities for the private sector. But I think in the end, you're going to have greater scope for private activity. I even think if you look at countries like Russia, a mess in many ways.
You're right.
You say, well, from a longer run evolutionary point of view, what could happen there? I see that there's a kind of light at the end of the tunnel vis-a-vis economic freedom. It goes something like this. Suppose you have stolen a lot of what you have. Suppose you got it by corruption. Suppose you got it by foul means. There comes a time when you'd like that to be legitimized so that you have a vested interest then in establishing a rule of law now that you've engineered your starting conditions in your favor. But nonetheless, whoever's there will want to have legitimacy, and legitimacy means, among other things, the respect of private property, however ill-begotten the origins may have been. Perhaps it's a bit like the robber barons of the so-called in U.S. history, so that even though you can run into periods where there are a diminution of economic freedom, I think there is nonetheless a tendency towards allowing people the right to the fruits of their labor. I hope so, anyway.
Well, it'll be interesting to follow this, and this is one of the reasons why I am excited about the project that we've both been involved in terms of developing a measure of economic freedom, because we do need an objective method of tracking this. And, you know, just a decade ago, I guess, when I first got involved in this, the idea of developing a measure of economic freedom was something alien to me. I'd never thought about the possibility of doing it. I dare say there was virtually no one in our profession that had. But yet, we've always, it's been pretty much a tenet of our profession that economic liberalization, particularly in areas that relate to trade, both domestic and foreign trade, allow us to have more gains from specialization. And that liberalization in terms of entry into business activity will lead to more economic progress. That after all, economic progress is about taking resources and combining them into a product where the product is more highly valued than the resources. And that without economic freedom, you don't have the opportunity to bring this intensive energy of individuals to
that. And
the
lack of economic freedom comes from a different form of taking. From the taking of one group of people from another, or from the government to another.
Exactly. So I think it will be fascinating to both see how some of these struggles between greater liberalization and the opportunities that creates for rapid economic progress in some countries, and whether or not governments will continue to allow that liberalization to take place. And of course, the movement of capital and people to more liberal areas. Also, that erodes the tax base, and it can be a positive element in terms of restraining government as well.
They're voting with their feet.
Voting with their feet. To see how all this plays out, and whether the next, not only the next century, but the next decade, whether or not we move more in the direction of economic freedom and economic progress, or whether we tend to undermine some of the progress that we've made in the last couple of decades.
Well, thank you, Jim. It's been a pleasure, our being able to discuss these matters this way.
It's always a pleasure to visit with you.
Thank you.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.